Very good. Thank you. I guess another announcement, because I don't want to overshadow it with Brent's announcement, but obviously today is my wife's birthday, and thankful for her addition to myself and our family, and certainly this church as well. My daughter said that it's on Facebook of her exact age, but so if you need to know, you have to go there to get it. But I'll just say this, there may be something, what we're doing with Brent, may be very soon on the horizon, as I guess is all I'll say for there. Yeah, that's all. It was just a warm-up. The problem with that is I can't say too much because then I follow shortly thereafter. And we don't want too many dress rehearsals for this. What was that? That's right. That's right. Well, this morning we are going to be in Numbers chapter 20 as we continue on with the children of Israel. And as far as a, again, what are you thinking series for this year, we're going to look at the essence of at times the frustrated thinking. And I would have to say we probably all have been there where we're just frustrated, where things just aren't going well. They're not falling into place like we wanted them to, whatever the scenario might be, and we find ourselves just frustrated, just maybe discouraged is a different word, but we seem to be at our mind's end as far as what to do and how to accomplish it. And I would dare say that while this, again, this passage is very familiar, one of the probably more familiar passages, in fact, I could say this, one of the only passages, ironically, of their 40 years of wandering. But I think it's important for us to look at it for the application of us today, now. And because we all find ourselves in times of frustration, whatever it might be. But before we dive into that thought, let's begin with a word of prayer. Lord, we thank you again for your word. I pray that our time together would bring honor and glory to you. Allow me to decrease, that you alone would increase here this morning. I just pray that the message would be clear. Certainly that I'd be able to live it out, but as well each one of us, that we would grasp the truth, grasp the lesson for us, and perhaps even change the direction of our feet. And we give you the glory as we look to your word now. In Jesus' name, amen. Story is told of a son of an unnamed and yet famous composer. Sometimes when they're unnamed, I begin to doubt the validity of said illustration. But I can say this, having lived with a musician, I know that this is very true regardless of who it applies to. So even if it is not truly an accurate tale of an actual composer, I can guarantee you this can and has undoubtedly happened. Not to give any hints for my children, though. It's said that this particular composer had a particularly rebellious child, and that might narrow down that list of composers. I don't know that all of them were married, and I'm not sure that all of them had children, but this one had a particularly rebellious son, and the son would come home at night, late at night, well beyond his expected or instructed time frame, and instead of sneaking off to his bedroom in the still of the night, he would go first to his father's piano, and slowly but as loudly as he could, he would play a scale, one note after the next, until he got to that last note, which he would leave unplayed. And then he'd go off into his bedroom, and the father, having been awakened by the sound of his piano in the other room, would hear that his son was once again home. But then he'd hear the scale being played out ever so slowly and then missing that last note. And he'd lay there in bed with great frustration. He'd lay there tossed and turned in his mind. He'd try to relax and go back to sleep, but in great consternation, he would eventually get out of bed and make his way to his piano and play that last remaining note so that he could return to his bed and fall back asleep. We probably all, and that's a humorous way, but we probably all had similar situations where things just weren't going the way that we hoped in that regard. Funny story is told as far as frustration goes, and certainly not supporting gambling, but it would be sort of funny for my daughters to remember this when they're on the airplane. If you ever flown, you know that you can have the greatest experiences and the worst experience, perhaps even in the same flight. The person that you're sitting next to or behind or in front of has a lot to do with the is the word enjoyability, the enjoyment of the flight. And well, here's a story of two that wound up side, complete strangers, wound up side by side on a particular long flight. A computer programmer and an engineer. And I don't know what the significance is of their professions, but nonetheless, a computer program and an engineer. The computer programmer looks to the engineer and asks if he wants to play a kind of a fun game. Not very hard, but it could last for quite a while if they'd like it to. And it'll be kind of fun. And the engineer was rather set to enjoy some sleep on the flight. And so he just nodded and said no, and he turned to the window in hopes of catching some sleep. The computer programmer kind of nudged him and said, well, let me tell you the game. Maybe you'd be interested then. And he explained that it would be such that this guy, the programmer, would ask the engineer a question, a random question. If he knew the answer, the question asker switched. If he didn't know the answer, he would have to pay the asker $5. And then it would switch. And so it would kind of be a way to kind of stumble each other. Here there are two well-educated men on a long flight. Let's see how this works out by the end of the flight. Who winds up being the smarter one of the two? And obviously it will cost them some money. Well, the engineer hears the plan of the game and still nods his head, shakes his head and says, no, he really would prefer just to go to sleep. So he again turns to the window and tries to doze off again. The computer programmer, frustrated, probably extremely bored, nudges him again. He says, all right, I will change the rules. He says, if I ask the question and you don't know it, you pay me $5. When it's your turn to ask me the question and I don't know it, I will pay you $50. Well, suddenly the engineer says, well, you should have started with that statement. Well, yeah, sir, we'll go with this. And so the computer programmer asks the first question. What is the distance of the Earth to the Moon? The engineer, without missing even a hesitation there, pulls out his wallet and gives him $5. No idea. All right, now it's his turn. So the engineer asks this question. What goes up a hill with three legs and comes down with four? The computer programmer thought for a little bit. Couldn't come up with an idea. He said, well, you give me a minute to try to think this through. He's like, take all the time you want. And the engineer turned back to the window and fell asleep. So the computer programmer, he gets out his computer, his laptop, and he's trying different things and trying to figure this out scientifically. What goes up the hill with three legs and comes down with four? And he can't find an answer anywhere. So he is able to kind of log onto the internet service on the airplane and sends an email to all those coworkers back on the ground to say, hey, here's this thing. It's going to cost me $50. Can you help me out? What goes up a hill with three legs and comes down with four? And all of his friends there on the ground, no idea. He's able to figure out how to get into the Library of Congress and examine some works there to figure out, well, there's got to be an answer to this. What is the answer? The engineer is sound asleep, so he's got all the time that he wants. He's searching and looking. He cannot find an answer. So finally, he pulls out his wallet, gets out $50, nudges the engineer back awake and says, I give up. Here's your $50. So he says, now it's my turn to ask the question. He's like, so what is the answer? Without missing the beat, the engineer pulls out his wallet again and hands him $5. A great way to play a wonderful game, get a nap out of it, and make $40. I guess is how that all worked out for him. We've all probably have been there, certainly not in an airplane with a computer engineer probably sitting next to us or a computer programmer. But frustrations from jobs, from politics, from finances, from health, frustrations perhaps even at times among friends, certainly among enemies, frustrations even in ministry and our service to the Lord, frustrations in things, even recreation sometimes. You ever found yourself getting discouraged? I've never played a game of golf in my life other than miniature golf, but I've heard that golf can be refreshing and the most frustrating thing ever. It's amazing how frustration can hit us in all facets of our life, even when we are doing our best to avoid it. This next passage is a pivotal breaking point for Moses. And in this Numbers chapter 20, just looking at the first 13 verses, we have the illustration of Moses, and I'll give you the details of it. We know this. This is when he's told to speak to the rock, and he strikes the rock out of frustration. And I think there's many lessons for us to learn. Probably you've heard sermons from this very passage before, and many applications for us to learn. But the first question I want to ask us, just kind of fill in the context, do you realize that from the last time we were here, we were in chapter 18 last week. Chapter 19 is just about sacrifices and the laws in that regard. Last week, as we were looking at chapter 18, recall they had just attempted to, they had sent the spies. They came back with the report. 12 men went to spy on Canaan. You know, I'm not going to sing the song, but 10 were bad and 2 were good. And the whole group has changed their mind, and they decided that they're not going to do it. They can't do it. And God judges them and says, hey, because you won't trust me, you're going to be wandering for 40 years. And then that very next morning, they decide that they're going to try to go anyway. And with that on the agenda, either we go into the promised land or we wander back in the wilderness for 40 years. Let's just go do this thing that God's called us to do. But they didn't take Moses, they didn't take Aaron, they didn't take the ark with them, and obviously they met instant defeat as they're chased back out. And so they begin their 40 years of wandering, and we have then Korah rising up in argument against Moses, and then the very next morning we have the congregation rising up against Moses, calling him and Aaron as murderers, and time and time again God declaring that he's going to wipe them all out, and time again Moses and Aaron standing in the gap between God and the people. That all happened within, we could say, the first 3 years of them leaving Egypt. When we come to chapter 20, we are now in the 40th year. There is nothing really recorded of their wanderings other than the fact that they wandered. The best description that we have is in Numbers chapter 33. It gives kind of a summary of their wanderings. And it literally goes, every verse is something along these lines. And they departed from, and it gives a place. And then they camped in, and it gives another place. And verse after verse after verse there in Numbers 33 gives they arrived here, then they left. And they arrived here, and then they left. And they arrived here, and then they left. But in verse 38 of Numbers 33, it says, and Aaron the priest went up into the Mount Hor at the commandment of the Lord and died there in the 40th year after the children of Israel were come out of the land of Egypt in the first day of the fifth month. So that's the death of Aaron, foretold and not foretold, it's declared, it's narrated in Numbers 33, 38. Aaron dies in the 40th year, first day, fifth month. Chapter 20, we come to verse 26, and we have the recording of Aaron's death. So Aaron dies here in Numbers chapter 20, which we know is in the 40th year. In verse 1, it says, then came the children of Israel, even the whole congregation of the desert of Sin, in the first month. And so the first month, seemingly 40th year, literally, what, 4 months before Aaron dies, this event happens. And so I think it all puts it in context, what is taking place here. They are at the end of their travels. They have made their way as they've wandered all through the wilderness. They're now making their way back to the borders of the promised land to try this one more time. And it's in that time frame, after about 37 years of unreported wanderings, who knows what has happened? I've got to speculate that what was happening before, all the complaining and the belly aching and the bitterness and griping, probably continued for all those years, but one by one, as was the plan of God, adult after adult has died off in those 40 years. And so we've come here to Numbers chapter 20, finishing out basically a purge of sorts, of all those who refuse to obey God and trust God. And we stand here 40 years later to see Moses in one of his not so splendid moments. Let me continue reading verse 1. Then came the children of Israel, even the whole congregation, into the desert of Zin in the first month. And the people abode in Kadesh, and Miriam died there and was buried there. I guess I didn't put the first point up here yet. We have the contagion in the frustrated thinking. You know what is interesting about frustration? Many times the things that frustrate us, in and of themselves, probably wouldn't have frustrated us if that was all that we were dealing with. You follow what I'm saying? The things that get us in life, on our day-to-day routines, in and of themselves, probably aren't really that big of a deal if that's all we had to deal with in that moment. But a lot of times there's things that have snowballed, and maybe things that we're holding on to for maybe days, weeks, months, years even, and we just begin to snowball, and those smaller things begin to add up to bigger things, and it begins to show itself in our frustration level. I'm not saying that we have any reason to, in our own lives, to point to other things and say, well, this is the reason. Nor can I look at verse 1 and point to Moses and saying, well, goodness, this guy lost his sister just not that long ago. Surely this is a low point of his life. Now, we know as well, he's about to lose Aaron as well in the next 4 months. And then about a month or two later, even his own life. But what we have in verse 1 is we have a, while it's just a narration of what happened, it has to have been a pretty difficult hit for Moses. It is speculated, although not confirmed, at least not biblically, that Miriam would be the sister that was appointed by Pharaoh to basically help raise him when Moses was hid in the water there in the little basket. And so Miriam literally is the sister that raised him, we could say, if that connection is truly made. But certainly we know in all these wilderness wanderings, remember, she was the one that after they crossed the sea, she's the one that held the little praise service and broke out the timbrel and started dancing and praising the Lord for all that he had done. And Miriam has been there right alongside Moses up to this point, until this point. But verse 2. And there was no water for the congregation, and they gathered themselves together against Moses and against Aaron, and the people chode with Moses and spake, saying, what would God that we had died when our brethren died before the Lord? And why have you brought up the congregation of the Lord into this wilderness, that we and our cattle should die there? And wherefore have we made us to come up out of Egypt to bring us into this evil place? There's no place of seed or of figs or of vines or of pomegranates, neither is there any water to drink. Now, several interesting points that I want to point out. The congregation has gathered themselves numerous times up to this point. The exact word that is used there in verse 2, that they've gathered themselves, is found, I believe, four other places in the Old Testament as far as the journey up to this point. And what I find fascinating is every time that the people have gathered, I don't know if we're not building a Bible doctrine here on this thing, but just presenting the facts, we'll say it that way. Up to this point, four times the people have gathered themselves together, and all four times it was met with judgment. The first time that we have them gathering themselves together was in Exodus chapter 32, when Moses has taken too long up on the mountain. And they gathered themselves together and directed Aaron to build them something to worship. In Numbers chapter 16, verse 3, it says, and they gathered themselves together against Moses and against Aaron and said unto them, you take too much upon you, seeing all the congregation are holy, every one of them, and the Lord is among you. Here in Numbers 16, we have the uprising, the beginning of the uprising of Korah. Again, they gather themselves together in argument or in opposition to Moses and Aaron. Same chapter, verse 19. And Korah then gathers all the congregation against them under the door of the tabernacle of the congregation. And again, this is when death is just about to happen on the horizon. Later on in that very verse, if you recall, verse 41 says, but on the morrow, right after the death of Korah and the other two families that are involved and the 250 men that are standing there with torches, on the morrow, it came to pass the whole congregation again gathered against Moses and Aaron, and that's when the plague hits. And here we have some 37-ish, 38 years later, the next recorded time, it says the people have gathered themselves together. And again, it was for no good at all. Now, I'm not trying to jump into political scenes, but it seems like our government for the last about year has been telling us not to gather together. certainly we have this, I don't think that's the application we should be taking. Don't gather together because things get bad when you gather together. It seems like the political statement of today, it certainly was a not very good statement of them back then. But I'm thankful that we can gather together today for the cause of our Lord instead of the cause of ourselves. It says in verse 3, and the people chode with Moses and spake, saying, would God that we had died when our brethren died before the Lord. You could literally say when our fathers and our mothers and our aunts and our uncles and our grandpas and our grandmas died before the Lord. And why have you brought up the congregation of the Lord into this wilderness that we and our cattle should die here? And then it's fascinating to me that they even say, why did you bring us up out of Egypt? The only people that are alive at this moment that were still back there, even at the time where we literally last left them, leaving the promised land with the realization that they can't take this at now because of their belief in a lie. We only have Moses and Aaron and Joshua and Caleb. Now Miriam has now just passed away. And the children that were alive at that moment. So the children now are 37, 38, up to 40 years older than they were at that point. Many of them had never even been in Egypt. Many of them never knew Egypt other than from the stories that had been told and replayed to them. Many of them were too young to even remember what happened the first time they tried to go into the promised land. Many of them don't recall the previous time when they cried out for water, because either they weren't born yet or they were too young to recall that. But it's amazing to me that for the children of the complainers, the children of the murmurers, here they are, literally almost word for word with what mom and dad said some 40 years earlier. And so as we consider the contagion, I think I have there on this, are they repeating words? It could just be that they're repeating the words that they heard from their mom and dad. Very possibly, their very last words of their mom and dad. Could you imagine as I complained to Moses, why'd you bring me out here to die? And then God says, because you have that kind of mindset, you are going to die. Your carcasses are going to drop here in the wilderness. Can you imagine as I'm breathing my last breath saying, perhaps even still in a murmuring fashion, why did Moses take us out here to die? So it's very likely that one of the last words that they've heard from their parents are literally being repeated right now. Are they just repeating words, or it is very likely that they are exhibiting a heart? They're exhibiting where their heart is. And as I consider this, as we examine our own hearts for frustration and how often we deal with it incorrectly, are we exhibiting a heart condition, or are we just merely repeating words? I don't know that there's a correct answer for that, because I think sometimes it's one or the other. But the truth is, I think we need to look at the why. We don't know the why, we don't know the basis here in Numbers chapter 20, but I think that we could look at our own hearts and say, sometimes I get in such a routine that in my mind I'm not even thinking anymore, and I'm just saying the same thing again and again and again. It's my same response that I've done again and again and again, because I've never considered, I've never looked at it, I've never contemplated what it is that I'm thinking, what I'm saying, it, or why I'm saying it. So there's the contagion. Be cautious with our frustration. It may be that the children or grandchildren are picking up on it. And it may be that they will be repeating our very frustration in the words that they say years later. But as well, examine our hearts, because that's even more important. Why is it that we are always getting frustrated? Look at the challenge in verse 6. And Moses and Aaron went from the presence of the assembly. It's not recorded here, but let me put the word again. Under the door of the tabernacle of the congregation, they fell upon their faces. And let me add that word one more time. Again. And the glory of the Lord appeared unto them. And I could add that same word in there one more time. Again. We have a challenge that is set before us as Moses and Aaron go before the Lord one more time for the children of Israel who are complaining about their circumstances, who are not content with where they are, who are coming to God in disagreement of what God is doing in their life. And Moses and Aaron one more time, and who knows how many times it's already happened in the last 38 years that we don't have recorded for us. They're doing it again, saying, Lord, what shall we do? Now, here's the challenge for our first challenge I have there for A. When I am in the midst of frustration, will I still go to my God? I can't imagine what it was like for Aaron and Moses. I can't imagine what it's like to have to deal with people who are constantly complaining. I can't imagine when they're dealing with the next generation and the very next generation is complaining just like the last. I've got to think, just as humanity speaks, I've got to think as a man that Moses and Aaron have had to have times where they've said, really, enough is enough, just stop already. But is in our time of frustration, where do we go? To whom are we going? Do we still go to our God? I know there's going to be a failure here in a moment, but I love the fact that Moses and Aaron still respond correctly at this moment as they go again to their God to beseech God. What's next? Verse 7. And the Lord spake unto Moses, saying, take the rod, and gather thou the assembly together, thou and Aaron thy brother, and speak ye unto the rock before their eyes, and it shall give forth his water, and thou shalt bring forth to them water out of the rock, so that thou shalt give the congregation and their beasts drink. A second interesting aspect about this. In previous attempts, a common response of God, and it involved usually two words, how long? How long will I deal with them? Moses and Aaron, separate yourselves because I will destroy them. For how long will I go with them? And here it seems to be absent of that. God doesn't ring out in rage. He's not responding in anger. He's not responding in, I'm going to bring judgment upon them. He literally tells Moses this key to the solution. You take your rod and you go out to this spot and you go to that rock and you speak to it and water will come out and they will have plenty to drink. There's no hint of judgment. There's no hint of God's anger of trying to destroy them or wanting to destroy them as he has had it said in the past. And so in the midst of the frustration, sometimes, as I have for number B there, or letter B there, are we waiting for God's mercy? Do we wait for God's mercy? Are we jumping? We're concluding things that shouldn't be concluded. Are we assuming things that shouldn't be assumed? Do we wait for God's mercy? When things aren't going right for us, are we waiting? Are we leaping? Are we waiting or are we running? Do we see God's mercy? Do we see his hand? Or am I so consumed with the moment that I've lost sight of it? Continuing on, it says to speak to the rock. Has that idea of a command. Something like, it would be something along the lines of this. This is not necessarily what Moses said. But the word there that is used has something along these lines. Moses was supposed to say, go to the rock with the rod and say, by the power of God, I demand that you bring forth water. It is a word that has the idea of not just speaking. He's not quoting the Pledge of Allegiance to this rock. He's not just quoting, boy, today is beautiful and out comes water. The word that is used there is ultimately that Moses is supposed to go to this rock and ultimately demand that it bring forth water. And in that demand, God promises that he will allow water to flow from out of this rock. You know what I find fascinating about my God? Perhaps what I find, if I could use the word frustrating, about my or our response to our God is how often we try to put him in a box. How often we try to squeeze him, the God that we cannot fathom with our own finite minds, we try to squeeze him into something that we can't fathom, and we put him in this little box that works for us, it fits it. It fits my theology and my ideology about who God is, and we run with it. But you know, the challenge here is not to fit God into a box. Previously, strike the rock. This time, demand verbally that the rock bring forth water. But last time you said, now this time you, well, and a lot of times I think in our own lives we become frustrated because we're too impatient with our God, and we expect our God, well, you did this way last time, therefore you have to do it this way this time. And you're not doing it this way this time, so I'm kind of lost in a puzzle here, and I don't know what's going on. Hey, don't put God in a box. Sometimes he asks us to do this, sometimes he asks us to do that in the exact same scenario. We've got to be patient, but we've got to be obedient. Verse 9, and Moses took the rod from before the Lord as he commanded him. This is interesting. This surely is not the rod that we know that budded from, called Aaron's rod. This is surely not that. But for whatever reason, Aaron's or Moses' rod is also before what we'd assume would be the ark, before the Lord. And so Moses' traditional rod is now also laid up. It is somewhat believed by scholars, much smarter than I, that it's certainly not inside the ark as Aaron's budding rod is. But perhaps it's on display there in the tabernacle as, you know, that's Moses' rod. Moses goes and he takes that rod. What I find very interesting in this regard, kind of a challenge of sorts, of how easy it is to jump to conclusions. Let me ask you this. Why was it necessary that Moses have his rod? He's not going to use it. God hasn't said, take the rod and strike the rock. God hasn't said, take the rod and wave it in the air. God hasn't said, take the rod and knock it three times while you're speaking. God has said nothing about the rod except go and take it. And so Moses is gone and he's taken his rod, but the command from God had nothing to do with the rod other than having it in his hand. And I think there's a lot of times that we can jump to conclusions. Well, God has had me use this rod in certain ways before, and so therefore the fact that he's had me bring it again, perhaps in Moses' justification, we don't know this, I'm just saying as humanity, because we still do this today. Well, I have this, you know, God provided this for me, and therefore I'm going to kind of assume here that with this, I'm supposed to do this, and here's the end result. Here's what I'm supposed to be doing. And we jump to conclusions. My wife is obviously an excellent cook in our home. And I know growing up, I did a lot of cooking and baking. And since then, since I've been married, not too much, Josiah and I, on the first Thursday of November, our one time, is Men Make Dinner Night, National Men Make Dinner Night. And I found that a few years ago and thought that'd be hilarious to see what the two of us could come up with. And we've come up with a theme every year since then at the first Thursday of November. And we usually have a certain dress code that we all wear, and we come up with a recipe that we have not had before. And Josiah and I try it out. And I think there's been some that, yeah, we either flopped or that recipe wasn't that good. Or there was some that I think they were pretty good. I can say this, I don't think there's been a single recipe that my wife has ever made after us. I don't think anything that we made on that November has ever been repeated once. I don't know what that says. But I'm not going to jump to conclusions. But you know, there's something interesting about a recipe. It's amazing when you have the list of ingredients, then you have the steps below, and there's a lot of times that as they word it, and it just seems like sometimes at least recipes, and again, I'm not well-versed in recipe reading, but in the recipes that I've read, they're kind of slow, and it's almost like they're setting you up for failure, because they'll say, mix all these ingredients together, and so you do that, and maybe it's on heat or not in heat, or you bake it for a little bit, or whatever the detail, but you put these together, and you do whatever it says. And then the very next words will say, mix this, this, and this together. And so, you know, it's easy to interpret then, well, now I've got this thing, now I'm going to start adding more. But you have to read the rest of that statement to say, separately. And that will make a huge difference in the outcome overall. And I can't tell you how many times that it would make a huge difference in a recipe if you just jump to a conclusion. Read it, follow it, and it'll work out. Read it halfway and make an assumption, probably won't work out. Now, back to Josiah and I, we have a lot of fun. We kick all the girls out of the kitchen and we make dinner and we even do the dishes. And 1 year we put on ball caps and we took water and flour. We put water here on our underneath and we put flour. So we look like baseball players with flour inside of black was white. And we made a whole meal looking like baseball players with flour under our eyes. And so we have more fun in the process. And then we kind of gulp our way through the meal perhaps at times. But you know, the truth is if we jump to conclusions when it comes to our God, I can almost guarantee you in all cases we have concluded incorrectly. And a lot of times I think our frustration is simply that, as letter D there, I've jumped to a wrong conclusion, and I wasn't even near the recipe. I wasn't even near the right direction. I wasn't near what God really had for me. I was in the wrong ballpark altogether. Verse 10, and Moses and Aaron gathered the congregation together before the rock. They said unto them, "Hear now, ye rebels, must we fetch you water out of this rock? Must we fetch you water out of this rock?" You know, the only thing that perhaps is ultimately wrong with this verse, were they not indeed rebels? God had already called them rebels in the past for their murmuring. For Moses to call them rebels, I don't think was out of, what am I trying to say, contrary to the past. Their very murmuring proved that they were rebels. "Hear us now, ye rebels, must we fetch water out of this rock?" Ultimately, I think the only thing that Moses did wrong at this point, in my judgment anyway, is his word of "we." You know, when things become frustrated in our lives, it's so often that we get in the way. When I am frustrated, when you are frustrated, I think we'd have to admit, probably for all of those points, but when I get frustrated, the problem of the frustration is I've put myself in the way of my God. And the easy solution is just for me to step out of the way and let God do what God's going to do. But I'm frustrated ultimately not because of my environment, not because of my surrounding, not because of the decision of others, not because of murmuring children of Israel. I am frustrated because I have put me there. And my focus is on me. Must we do this for you? It was God that was going to do this. It wasn't Moses that was going to do this. But in Moses' eyes, and again, we don't know what has happened the last 38 years. I have got to think that it started and continued, and now we catch back up with them in year 40, and it's still obviously the same way that it was some 40 years ago. And I've got to think that that has continued consistently all the way through. And so I can't tell you what it would be like for an elderly Moses to continually be dealing with the murmuring and the rebellion and the griping of an entire nation of people, always coming to Moses and Aaron with their gripes and their complaints against their God. I can't even fathom the frustration level that they must have felt from a past 40 years. But that does not justify Moses standing in the middle. That does not justify Moses saying, "Must we do this?" It would have been justified to say, "Do we need God to show himself one more time before you will trust him?" That would have been a pleasant way of kind of striking them right between the eyes. Must we have God provide for us again before you will truly trust him? Before you will truly acknowledge him? Before you will truly go to him first? Before you will stop complaining about this now? Must God do this one more time? That should have been his response. And I think he would have been justified for that response. But instead, his response, and I can't point any fingers at him more than I can point at my own heart. How often when we find ourselves in those moments, we step right in the middle of it all, and it's all about us. Why me? Why now? So the challenge here is, in the midst of frustration, will we step out of the way? It's not about us. It's not us. It's not you, Moses. But it's not us either. Verse 11. And Moses lifted up his hand, and with his rod he smote the rock twice. And the water came out abundantly, and the congregation drank, and their beasts also. The faithful end ultimately of Moses and Aaron, the rock is struck twice. It's amazing to me that water still comes out. It's amazing to me that God still fulfilled his promise, even though Moses didn't fulfill his. But as we acknowledge that, do we not still stand in awe of our God who still does the same today? He still fulfills his promises even when we fail on our end. I'm in awe of that. But we have to be reminded, in the midst of frustration, the end does not justify the means. Well, it all worked out, you guys, you filthy rebels. You got your water that you wanted. It's all good. We're fine to go here, and on we go. No, that's not how it all works out. Judgment now falls upon Moses, because the end isn't justify the means. The fact that God was faithful doesn't remove the fact that we were unfaithful. The fact that God still continued to do what God promised to do doesn't remove the fact that Moses refused to do what Moses was supposed to do. And the same still falls on our lives. Now, we're not the children of Israel. We're not in the Old Testament time frame. We're fortunately on this side of the cross, and God deals with us differently. I'm thankful for that. But I think there's still much that can be applied to us today. I think there's still much that can be challenging for us today. But look at verse 12. Not only do we have the contagion that we have to remember, are we repeating words or exhibiting a heart? I don't know. It could be either one. Not only do we have the challenge, it truly is a challenge. Will I still go to the Lord? Will I wait for His mercy? Will I avoid putting God in a box? Will I not jump to wrong conclusions? Will I step out of the way? And will I not justify the end by the means? Because it worked out well, doesn't matter how we got there, just concluded well, so all is well. No, was I faithful in the process? Did I follow God in obedience to the end? Or am I just taking credit for the fact that God still did what God did, even though I completely failed all the way through? I'm still responsible for me. But lastly, what was the cause? I find this truly challenging. What was the cause of it all? Look at verse 12. And the Lord spake unto Moses and Aaron, because, there's three things here, because you believed not to sanctify me, number two, in the eyes of the children of Israel, therefore ye shall not bring this congregation into the land which I have given them. Verse 13, this is the water of Meribah, because the children of Israel strove with the Lord, and he was sanctified in them. There's three results here that I think are good for us to remind ourselves of. Number one, what was the cause? Why were they punished? Why was Moses and Aaron not allowed now to go into the promised land? If you keep in mind of the time frame, this isn't during the 40 years of wandering. This is at the end of the 40 years of wandering. This wasn't at the beginning or in the middle. This was at the end. This is months before Moses would die. And immediately after Moses' death, they go into the promised land. They are months away from finally getting back to where they should have been 40 years earlier. And so Moses isn't punished and then had to wander himself for 40 years in his punishment. Moses has faithfully followed through with God for 40 years of wandering as he's dealt with rebellious children of Israel for those 40 years. And here at the conclusion of it all, Moses strikes when he should have spoke. And at the conclusion of 40 years of dealing with, to use the word, rebels, he is punished from going into a land that he said 40 years ago we could do. Why? Number one, because they did not believe God. Moses did not believe God. Do you think for any moment Moses did not believe that water would come out of that rock? I think Moses truly, he had done it before. He had seen water come out of rocks. He had seen God do miracles before. I fully believe in my heart that Moses had great confidence that God could once again provide for them as he had done repeatedly in the past. I have no questions on that, personally. What is evident, though, is that Moses refused to believe God in doing as God had commanded him to do. And sometimes it's easy for us to say, well, I believe God. I have faith in God. I know he's going to work this out. But we refuse to. We have a lack of faith in simply obeying God in the steps that he's called us to take. Faith is a word of action, not just a word of words. Faith requires action. Faith is an action of obedience. Obedience in action. The list of heroes of the faith in Hebrews chapter 11 are men and women who didn't just say, I believe in God, and I believe God will do this. They're men and women who stepped out in obedience and did what God said to do, even in challenging times. What would it be like for Abraham to offer up his one promised son? You've got one son, and I've told you you can be the father of many nations. Now go and offer that one son before me. Whew. I believe you, God. I believe that you are God. I believe that you are a good God. I believe that you are a merciful God, but I can't do that. He would not have been listed in Hebrews chapter 11, except that he took a two-day journey to the top of a mountain to exactly where God told him to, exactly the time frame God told him to, with his son and some kindling and the means for a fire with the very purpose of sacrificing his son. Why? Because God told him to. That's what faith is about. I can't believe what it would have been like to leave a home and wander to a place that and God's not going to tell you where to go. I believe it was my grandparents, my dad's parents, I think, for their honeymoon. I think they just left. They headed south and didn't have a destination, if I recall. I think they just decided, well, you know, wherever we stop is where we're stopping. I think they wound up in Louisiana or something like that, if I recall. New Orleans, yeah. And so that's where they that was their honeymoon. Let's just get in the car and go. And I think sometimes my wife fears that I'm going to become too much like my grandpa at times. Let's just get in the car and go. Let's see where we were driving and the other day. Josiah says, hey, Dad, where's that road go? Turn signal out. Let's go find out. I have no idea. We'll find out. You know, the truth is there are times we have to acknowledge that God says very clearly, here's what you need to do. And yet in our minds we say, God, I believe you, but I can't do that. It's literally what Moses did here. I believe he truly had complete faith in God that God would provide water. I don't have any doubt that Moses doubted that fact. But Moses did not have enough faith to obey God in all the steps that God called him to do. Number one, you did not believe me. Number two, this is humbling. You did not sanctify God before others. How many opportunities do we miss to set God apart before the eyes of others? How many opportunities do we have where we become tunnel visioned on the murmuring, on the complaining, on the situation, and we completely leave God out of the equation? We completely leave God out of the solution. And those around us, maybe coworkers, neighbors, friends, family members, they miss out on the opportunity to see God do what only God can do in a way that God can only do it, simply because I have not set God apart in my own heart, so that he can be set apart in their lives as well. Take the example, and I've used this before, but again, was it Paul and Silas, I think, on this trip? Philippi, singing in prison at midnight? I've used that illustration many times. That's hard to do. That's very hard to do. Things are not going well. I'm in a dungeon. It stinks. There's murderers and thieves surrounding me, and all I have done is done what God has. I've accomplished what God called me to do. After the fire, here at the church, and they had the news. The fire chief was speaking about me. He done what he was supposed to do. I've done what I was supposed to do. That's what I've done. Well, that's what they done as well. That's what they did as well. And there's at times that we have to be reminding ourselves that, hey, they didn't sanctify God before others. Do I live such a life that as I'm going through even the frustrations of life, that in my mind I have the constant reality of others' view of God may only be through my life? That's a humbling reality. The view that others have of who God is may only be seen, because they're not reading their Bible. They don't maybe even have a Bible. But the view that others have of God is only seen through me. Think on that next time you're frustrated about life. That neighbor only knows about God through what they see God through me. What is their view of God? What did Moses do? He failed to sanctify God before others. 1 Peter 3:15, directed towards a persecuted church, says, but sanctify, same words, except that's in the Greek instead of the Hebrew, sanctify the Lord God in your hearts, and be ready always to give an answer to every man that asks you a reason of the hope that is in you with meekness and fear. Even in the midst of persecution, persecuted church, live out such a life that those that surround you who are wicked, who are rebels, who have denied God, live such a life that they can see me in you. that they know why it is that you do what you do, that they might know that it is because you have set me apart in your heart, in your life, that you have sanctified God before you, so that it might have an impact on them. Moses, you failed in that way. But in verse 13 here at the very end, kind of a last point. This is the water of Meribah, because the children of Israel strove with the Lord, and he was sanctified in them. This spot, this rock, this water, this very place would forever be known. In fact, even so today, it's recorded for us, for today. This spot is still known by this name, which means strife. For the rest of time, wherever that rock is, will always be known as that. This moment right here, right now, Moses, you failed, and forever this place will be called, and ultimately to point out your failure before a rebellious people. What a horrid reminder of our own failure. Who's thirsty? I'll go back to that water of Moses strife. I can't imagine what that was like. But it's because the cause, they forgot the cause. They misunderstood the reason. Moses, obviously he did something he should not have done. But before we wag our heads or shake our heads and wag our fingers, however that phrase goes, before we cast judgment upon Moses for his failure, I trust we can look at our own hearts and lives and ask ourselves, when I'm frustrated, what is my response? What do I do? Am I still believing my God? I'm not asking, do you still have faith in God? Do you still believe there's a God? That's what I'm asking. Do you believe him enough that you will obey him even though it's hard? Even though it seems impossible? Even though it doesn't make sense? Even though nobody else is? Even though, and you fill in whatever the reasoning is, will you still believe God? Will you follow him in obedience? Will you set him apart that even in the midst of whatever is driving us bananas, that we are living with such an attitude that I want to sanctify God in my hearts, not only because it's, well, commanded of 1 Peter 3:15 for me today, but as well because we have the example of Moses, who reminds us that as I do that, I have an opportunity to impact an entire nation. If I would live this way. And I'm thankful that God doesn't name, okay, could you imagine today if we had a location for every failure we had and it was named, God named it based on that failure. Been here now 19 years. In fact, hey, this is the first Sunday of February. 19 years ago today, whenever, I think it was actually the third, I think, that year, was our first time we ever were here in Toulon. Had never heard of Toulon before today. And here we are 19 years later. But 19, where was I going with that? Oh, as I've been then on the fire department for those 19 years and the ambulance for many of those years, it's funny, or not funny, I shouldn't say funny, it's humbling as I drive around and I can recall I had a medical call and it wound up with a fatality in that house and there was an accident and this happened here and I remember this place and I remember that place. It's sometimes annoying almost to drive around and just driving past a home, you recall that exact moment. You drive past an intersection and you recall the last breath of somebody before they pass into eternity. And as 19 years of going through that, there's a lot of corners, there's a lot of houses, there's a lot of circumstances that I've been a part of in those 19 years. But could you imagine living out a life that every failure that I had, God named the place to remind all of humanity of my failure? That's humbling. I'm thankful that our God is a merciful God and doesn't do that today. And I stand humbled as I realize how if we were in Moses' shoes as we live today, we were there then, that water of Meribah may very well have been named because of my lack of obedience. Do you get that? Do we understand that? Do we, as the New Testament says, learn from that? Is it for our ensample that these things are written for us? May we learn. Let's pray. Lord, I thank you again for your word. I thank you for the example Certainly a familiar passage, certainly one that we probably have all heard before many times. But I do pray that we be challenged by the reality of how do I handle what frustrations in our life. We all do. There are things probably right now in each one of our hearts and our lives that, frankly, are frustrating. We just wish they weren't going that way. But I pray that we be reminded by the example of Moses that there is a way to still get through this and glorify you. And there's a lot of things that need to be done. There's a lot of steps that need to be accomplished. But there is a way that even in the midst of this, that you can be glorified. And probably one of the bigger ones is we simply need to remove ourselves out of the way. We need to stand in awe of you and follow in obedience regardless. Regardless of what the cause is, what the means is, what the environment is, what the ultimate underlying situation is, that we will still have a faith in you and follow in obedience because of you, sanctifying you in our hearts so that those around us may be impacted, not by us, but by you. And I pray that you'd give us those opportunities here this week, realizing that by asking that, we're asking for frustrations. But I pray that we'd be able to live those out victoriously before others for your honor and for your glory. In Jesus' name, amen.